Okay, so last week we went over all of the kind of conceptual elements of alchemical thinking and what alchemy is in terms of spiritual alchemy and how all of that works. This week we are going to talk about laboratory processes in alchemy. One thing that we did not do last week, which is
Still
like
there.
necessary for it to be one of my classes, is to have me complain about other writers and
Yeah,
magicians.
why didn't you?
I don't know, I was very well behaved last week. There was like,
Am I
it
like
was,
channeling you?
I don't know, it was like the most polished class ever. You kind of do seem to be.
Yeah, because
Like,
I'm here. You
because
guys
I
are
wasn't
different.
yeah, it was like, you see, I was like, Stephanie seems like as stressed as I've been and like very on edge. Like,
I'm just
it's like when I
tired.
can tell over text messages that you're like,
I'm tired. I had lots of chicks at my house.
But
All that estrogen is too much for my house.
yes. Did James tell you that he missed my man event so you could be at your chick
I already knew because he asked me, "What are you doing in your second?" I said, "Something. Can't have it." He was unhappy. And I told him like 10 times before that, so
I
touch
shared my
it.
jalapeno poppers with Beth because I love her.
Oh.
He's coming Friday, so he gets another one.
That's good. Oh, you guys didn't find a babysitter?
We
That
have
sucks.
one for Saturday night.
Oh, that's good.
Because I figured that's
That'll be the
more
more
fun.
fun.
It will be.
Okay, so I need to take a moment and talk about some people who are cool and talk about someone who sucks. In last week's class, I didn't mention books that are good books to look at for the most part. Which is usually one of the things I start off with a class where it's kind of a new class on that topic. And what led to doing that in this class is that because this class is more about the laboratory process, it's a little easier to identify good books on the laboratory process than the spiritual alchemy stuff. The kind of main classic for a long time has been The Alchemist's Handbook by Fredo Albertus, which did get mentioned a little bit last time. That has, for a long time, been the book that's kind of been, if you want to start looking at laboratory alchemy, check that book out. If you want to have a well-rounded occult library and you have no real interest in alchemy, but you want to kind of look like you know something about it, then pick up that book. Because it was
Who is it written by?
Fredo Albertus. He ran the Paracelsus Research Society, and kind of had sort of an alchemical college going on under the auspices of Amwork for a while. Another book from that same period of like, I guess that probably came out in the 70s, maybe the 80s, I'm not really sure. It was by Manfred Junius, who also got mentioned a little bit last week. The book was originally Practical Plant Alchemy. Now it has been retitled as Spagyrics. And we'll talk a little bit, well, actually, a good bit, about the difference between alchemy and Spagyrics tonight.
Could you spell that, please?
Spagyrics.
And who is that?
By Manfred Junius. You're welcome.
As opposed to Manfred Mann.
A more modern book is Brian Cutnoir's The Wiser Concise Guide to Alchemy. Now this is actually one of my favorite books on lab alchemy, and it's right in front of me because I'll just be using it tonight for one portion that we'll be talking about. I've actually purchased 3 copies of this book. Like it's a pretty fun book. I think of it as a good beginner primer. John Reed, who is a well-known contemporary alchemist, he thinks that it's a little bit more of an intermediate to an advanced book. I'm not really sure why, though. And then on the topic of Reed, Reed has an online book, Practical Plant Alchemy, which is excellent and goes through the basic elements of spiritual alchemy as well as the basic elements of plant spagyrics. And then he has a sort of photo spread on making an alchemical stone after he's already given instructions on making a plant stone. Now, part of what led me to think of bringing up the books tonight is kind of this question of the difference between alchemy and spagyrics. And in trying to figure out how to answer what the difference between the two is, I recalled a conversation that happened between John Reed and Rufus Opus and myself. Now,
this
I know...
This can only be entertaining.
Oh, yes. There are a few people around the lodge who read Rufus's blog, or are friends with Rufus on Facebook. For those not familiar with him, he actually does live in the area. And is one of the more accomplished and skilled magicians that's around these days. John, I believe, is out in California, and I think he mostly is involved in alchemy, but has other occult connections. I'm not really sure what he's into or does outside of the alchemy stuff, but he's pretty solid in alchemy. He's kind of one of my modern alchemical heroes. So, in terms of the difference between spagyrics and alchemy, I could never find a really good answer to what the difference was. Like, I had kind of a general idea, but most books would use the terms almost interchangeably. Most websites would use the terms almost interchangeably. The point where one day Rufus bought a snakeskin and wanted to make snake oil, kind of as a joke. And he read about the spagyric processes and was going to use the snake oil, the snake skin to make the snake oil using spadgery. And then he realized that you couldn't use the same process. And he posted on a list, which Suze, who was here last week, and I run, about how spagyrics is only plant alchemy, so he couldn't use it for his snake skin. So I explained that spagyrics isn't plant alchemy. That plant alchemy is its own thing, spagyrics is its own thing, and the two overlap. And kind of threw out my guess that one of the main differences is that the whole purification and transmutation is not a part of spagyrics. Spagyrics is only separating and recombining. And that a lot of people think of it as training wheels alchemy because it works in the plant kingdom and the plant kingdom is easier to work with, but that you could take a spagyric approach to any of the kingdoms because it's not really alchemy. It just uses alchemical techniques. And then I asked John to step in and help and explain what the actual difference is. So rather than try to recreate that, I've just brought John's explanation, which starts off with, all things alchemical are spagyric, not all things spagyric are alchemical. Spagyrics is the process of separation and recombination. The step of purification is a supposition, but is not inherent in the meaning of the word itself. Now, there are a multitude of ways to go about separating and recombining a thing, as well as purifying a thing. Not all of them come close to the philosophical underpinnings of alchemy. He then goes on to explain that if you look at the early materials coming from Frater Albertus and the laboratory bulletins and Parachemy magazine that were coming out of the Paracelsus Research Society, that early on the articles are all alchemical. And then Albertus has a point where he makes a note about how they're only going to be putting the organization's outer order work in these publications from here out. And so the outer order work was all spagyrics. There wasn't actual alchemy in it. And so John notes that a lot of what you see today being sold as information on alchemy is really just information on spagyrics, because most contemporary alchemists were trained primarily from reading the published work coming from Albertus and his associates. Now, in explaining the difference, John says, for the spagyricist, nature provides the three essentials in an outward manner, meaning through simple manipulation of matter, one is able to get the essential oils, salts, and alcohol, representing in a metaphorical way soul, body, and spirit, respectively. Yet for the alchemist, the matter nature presents us with is at best what one would term one of the four elements. It is then up to the artist to intermix these substances to make the three essentials. For the spagyricist, ethyl alcohol is the mercury of the plant kingdom. For the alchemist, it is a substance that behaves as the ancients have described the mercury, with its ability to separate out the essentials of the subject matter immersed into it. So his big distinction there is that the Spagyricist is dealing with just the physical matter in front of them. That to them, the ethanol that they're dealing with is mercury. To the alchemist, the ethanol simply represents the mercury. So the physical processes being engaged in by the Spagyricist and by the alchemist largely overlap. But the alchemist is taking them in a deeper level in which they're representative of something else that's going on. And I'm kind of jumping around here in my notes a little bit. But basically, the alchemist approaches things a little bit more along the lines of what we talked about last time with kind of the being and essence dichotomy. That the alchemist is dealing with the essence of the thing or the platonic reality that's represented by the thing with which he's working, whereas the Spagyricist is dealing simply with what's in front of him. In looking at this differentiation between Spagyrics and alchemy, we can also look at the difference between Spagyric methods of mixation and simple methods of mixation. One of the terms that we'll see turn up frequently in alchemy is a tincture. And I'm guessing most people are familiar with tinctures in some context. But basically a tincture is when you have some carrier substance, typically a form of alcohol, that has another substance added to it so that the alcohol can take on the nature of the thing that's being placed into it. A simple tincture, which is the type of tincture that's usually taught in herbalism and most forms of witchcraft, you basically either take the herb or plant, or you take the essential oil from the herb or plant, and you mix that in with the alcohol. Usually something not particularly refined, often something like vodka, where you're going to have a fairly clean base that's not going to throw off what it is that you're mixing into it too much. So there's nothing going on with the preparation of either item or the purification of either item. You're just taking one stock item and another stock item and putting them together. In Spagyrics, when making the tincture, you would actually go through a process of separating out the alcohol from the product that you're using as your basis and separating out the oil from the product that you're using as your basis and combining that alcohol and that oil that way. And you may use the salt from the plant as well in order to further augment the tincture, depending on which kind of school of alchemical thought you're basing your tincture method on. In alchemy, you would take it further, and your tincture wouldn't simply be, okay, well, I've got this piece, and this piece, in which case your mercury in Spagyrics might be mercury that's coming from the object with which you're working. Like, so say you are making a tincture of melissa or lemongrass, which is one of the common kind of starter things to do. Then in a Spagyric work, you might make the ethanol from the lemongrass, or you might make the ethanol from wine, or you might simply go and purchase ethanol. In an alchemical work, you would make the ethanol from the lemongrass, because part of the process would be understanding the way in which breaking down the lemongrass in order to make the ethanol teaches you about the nature of the mercury and the nature of the essence of the lemongrass, so that you're experiencing that change as the material is experiencing the change. The other thing that you can kind of take from this description of the difference between alchemy and Spagyrics is that you have to approach alchemy with kind of a buyer beware mentality. That you're going to see a lot of things where they're going to say, oh, this is a book on alchemy, or this is a class on alchemy, or come to this alchemy workshop, and really they're just going to be teaching you Spagyrics. Or they could just be teaching you made-up nonsense, which is what a lot of them will be doing. But even many of the ones that are going to be teaching you about laboratory processes will be primarily focusing on Spagyrics. Most of the things that I've done have been primarily Spagyrical. I've done some things that work a little bit more on the alchemical end, but the large largest things I've done have been Spagyric, just because of space and equipment constraints. That's just to let you guys know where I'm coming from in terms of my base knowledge. But in short, many of the activities which the contemporary laboratory alchemists will engage in are Spagyric, but you can always elevate them to the level of actual alchemy. And sometimes this is not just done by adding in extra meditation and extra reflection. Sometimes, in order to do this, you have to go through the alchemical processes in a much more significant manner and engage in a lot more of the processes, like how I noted with creating a tincture of melissa. You would go ahead and actually break down the lemongrass if you were doing it alchemically. And so this is kind of a good stepping point into talking about how the processes work. Because if you are doing something alchemically, for example, in John's book, Practical Plant Alchemy, like I said, he gives a description of how to make a spagyric stone. Like, he gives you all the steps that you do for that. For making an alchemical plant stone, he gives you a series of photographs. And the photographs go through a lot more steps than those that are described in the spagyric work. And when he talks about some of the things that he had to do along the way in order to make it work, some of the things that had to be introduced in order to activate some of these metaphysical principles that are going on in the alchemical work, where they were specific physical things that he had to do, definitely stepped beyond those things that you would need to do in making the equivalent spagyric element. So for the basic processes, you can divide them out into separation, purification, and recombination. And at least this is one way in which you can divide the processes. There are several. Separation deals with obtaining the three principles, which are salt, sulfur, and mercury. Now, last time we discussed these conceptually, but didn't really deal with them too much physically. Physically speaking, these principles are all represented differently throughout the different kingdoms. The principal alchemical kingdoms are the plant, the animal, and the mineral kingdom. Sometimes you'll hear people say the metal kingdom, the metal and mineral kingdom are the same thing. Within the plant kingdom, the salts are the actual salts that make up the physical body of the plant, and these may be either soluble or insoluble. Salt here is not simply a metaphor. Chemically, these components of the plant are actual salts. But the term salt overall refers to the purified physical body. So once the physical body has been removed of all components that are not essential to its being, that is the salt of the plant. The sulfur refers to oils. So basically the essential oils of the plant. Now if you think about the function of these oils, they tend to provide the scent and flavor that goes into the characteristics of the plant. Some of the other characteristics in terms of the way in which the plant is colored, some of its texture, are related to its oil content as well. So a lot of what is defining the sense characteristics of the plant as separate from the sense characteristics of other plants is related to, or are related to, the oils of the plant. Which is basically what the function and nature of sulfur is that sulfur is giving you those defining characteristics that direct one thing from another thing and show how this thing is going to manifest as its own thing itself, as opposed to being the same as everything else. Another way you can kind of look at the function of the oils in the plant is that they're kind of based in the lipids that are holding together a lot of the different elements of the body of the plant. So you have the salt, which is what fixes the volatile. But those actual salts within the plant are being held together by the different fluid components of the plant and the different cellulose characteristics that go into creating the actual physical body of the plant. And those are tied up with those same portions that are creating the oils and the sulfur of the plant. So the thing that draws it together and catalyzes it into being, in some sense, again relates to that sulfur, which is the alchemical nature of the sulfur. The mercury within the plant kingdom is ethanol. Plants produce various alcohols when they are fermented. Not all of them are consumable. And ethanol...
consumable, you just might die.
Yes. Not all of them are potable. And that may be part of why ethanol was favored as the universal substance to come from plants, because it could be drunk and it was fun to drink. I don't know. But typically what it is that's defined as why, or explained as to why it relates to mercury, is that it's the universal plant solvent. once you refine ethanol from a plant, the ethanol is basically the same, regardless of what its source was. And you can then have that ethanol leach out elements of whatever plant is placed into it, regardless of where the ethanol came from. So you can make ethanol by distilling alcohol out from wine, but then you could take galangal and put that in the ethanol and have elements of the galangal leached out to tinct the ethanol. So regardless of where the ethanol came from and what's being put into it, the ethanol functions as a solvent within the plant kingdom, taking out elements from other plants. It breaks down the spagyric components of plants. As plants are exposed to the ethanol, if the content isn't high enough, then there will continue to be fermentation and further breakdown. Otherwise, you just start to have that dissolution happening, because the ethanol is rather hygroscopic and will draw out all of the different elements of the watery components of the plant, as well as the other things that are water-soluble within the plant. Within the animal kingdom, you have a somewhat similar series of components, because it's another kingdom composed of living creatures. Differing texts, however, will give differing accounts of what the substances used in the animal kingdom are. And some of this is because it is a significantly rarer form of alchemy. Typically, you'll start off in the plant kingdom, working laboratory alchemy there, and then you'll move to the mineral kingdom. Most alchemists skipped the plant kingdom entirely. The plant kingdom was considered somewhat taboo for the animal kingdom, yes. I'm sorry. They skipped the animal kingdom entirely because the animal kingdom was somewhat taboo. And there are different reasons why this could be. Some people may have viewed it as being more dangerous because the types of germs and infections that you could have from handling the material used in the plant kingdom could be greater, or the animal kingdom could be greater. There could be kind of a belief that there's a greater potency to the alchemical work that's done in the animal kingdom over what's done in the plant kingdom. And just in general, kind of the social concern of handling body parts or animal parts or things that are coming from either human or animal bodies, and kind of that being a little bit more risque than cutting up a bunch of plants and dissolving them in order to make wine. The majority of classical texts on animal alchemy basically talk about using human shit as the basis for your alchemical work, and suggest that the entirety of the animal stone can be created from parts which can be derived from feces. That said, there are other texts that talk about other important components that can be taken from the animal kingdom, and you can cover the full gamut of principles from other sources in the animal kingdom. Sal ammoniac, or ammonia salt, is one of the most important salts in alchemy, and that can be derived from the animal kingdom through urine. But that particular salt is used frequently in plant alchemy as well. because it's considered one of the kind of highest level salts available. There is one classical alchemical text that talks about creating the oil or the sulfur of the animal kingdom from eggs by hard boiling eggs, removing the yolks, chopping up a series of egg of hard boiled egg whites and putting them into egg whites from which where the yolks have been removed, and then hanging them from strings in an incubator, during which time in the incubator the whites within the other egg whites will liquefy and create an oily substance that is described as being the sulfur of the animal kingdom. Manfred Junius notes that that semen holds a great deal of animal mercury, probably because it's largely composed of sugars, and so it can be fermented down to an alcohol substance. Blood is also a source of animal sulfur in addition to the eggs. There is a text which describes basically calcining blood down to a black goo and then producing the animal sulfur from that black goo from the blood. So there are several ways in which you can derive the components of the animal kingdom without using human feces. But most alchemical dilettantes will tell you that everyone knows that feces is where the components in the animal kingdom come from. And that takes us to the idea of purification. So the processes of purification in spagyrics and to some degree in alchemy within the plant kingdom are often a continuation of the process of separation. For example, when you are purifying salts, you might continue a circulation process in order to continually sublimate and then congeal the salt over and over again. The same with certain liquids. You might do purifications or rectifications of your ethanol distillate and basically just continue distilling the ethanol over and over again, even past the point where you would have a relatively pure distillation because of the alchemical significance of the number of times which you are distilling. Sometimes purifying is the separation itself, and this is typically when you have purification through the process of decay. And these ideas of decay are often described as opening the body, in which case you are taking the physical material which you're using and releasing the internal components in order to process them. So in the case of fermentation, you are causing a form of decay that releases the ethanol from the body. With putrefaction, you may be releasing ethanol, or you may be releasing sulfurs by allowing different parts of the body to just completely rot off. Different forms of burning can be used in order to reveal the salts of a matter, and basically you are burning off everything that's impure and incorrect as a form of purification, but that purification is also that process of separation in order to separate out the salts.
So if you cremate a body, is what's left considered the salts?
What's left would give you the ashes from which you would derive the salts.
Okay.
So I hadn't looked at that. In the next week, is probably when I will talk about the Philosopher's Stone in detail. And part of what I've mentioned tonight is kind of a lead into that. But I had never thought about generating salt from corpses. It's a good
idea. I have ashes at home if you want them.
Recombination then. Refers to any of various means of recombining the parts. And this will occur in different ways dependent upon which parts you're recombining, because not all alchemical processes will use all three of the principles. It will also depend on how the parts have been processed and what the overall goal is. Again, some forms of recombination are as simple as dissolving one thing into another or pouring a liquid over a solid for it to be absorbed. Others are more complicated, such as circulatory processes. Now, in terms of the specific processes of alchemy, these are often given in sets of differing number, and you'll sometimes see people argue over what is the correct number of processes. There's another organization which I kind of belong to or belonged to, I'm not really sure anymore what it is. And Suze, who was here last week, was also a member of this organization. And there is a bit of a debate within the organization as to whether or not to use a series of 12 alchemical processes, 10, or 7, because you'll see different authors refer to different sets of processes, with those as being three of the main sort of numbers of processes that you'll run into. And you'll see people make arguments like, well, if you have 12, then they line up to the zodiac, or if you have 10, then they line up to the Kabbalah, or 7 lines up to the planets. And you have like different things that people think are important in terms of how you can correspond the processes to other ideas. And that's really great as far as spiritual alchemy goes, or as far as trying to think of magic in alchemical terms, but it has nothing to do with actual laboratory alchemy because there is no clear set of processes that you're always going to use and use all of them. It all depends on what exactly it is you're doing, which kingdom you're working in, what material you're working in within that kingdom, and what your goal is as to which processes you're going to use. Now, in terms of the different processes, Cut Noir gives a really good list with descriptions. And so rather than just like retype notes with him, because I know I was just going to reference him, I just brought the book, and that's why I have it. Now, one of the differences between what Cut Noir describes and what I've described is that I broke down alchemy into kind of three categorizations of processes. He takes Gerber's method or Jabir's method, whether you're using the Latinization or the actual Arabic name, of breaking it down into four, which are purification, solution, coagulation, and combination. The processes that he gives are calcination, which we've talked about several times, burning things down to ash in order to purify them. Circulation, which again we've talked about a few times, where you evaporate something in a chamber so that once it remove the vapors remove itself from the source of heat, they it's like a second grade word too.
Condense.
Yes, condense, thank you. They recondense and fall back to the bottom, to the heat source, and then reevaporate again. So you cycle them through a cycle of evaporation and condensation. Cohobation, which is pouring a distillate back over the remains from which it was distilled. So if you are removing an oil out from a plant or removing liquids out from a salt that the salt has been dissolved or mixed into, you could then pour them back over it in order to recombine them that way. Congelation, which is the turning of a liquid into a solid. He uses ice as an example, or the solidification of mass due to the loss of water or another solvent. And he compares it to crystallization, which he then gives as another process.
Making candy.
Yes. That's one of the ways in which most people are familiar with it. We see it frequently in the temple when the blue bowl is left out and the water hasn't been poured out. The salt that's dissolved into the water crystallizes as the water evaporates. Then there's digestion, which was always one of my favorite alchemical terms, in which case you basically cook something in a slow, very low heat. Kind of drying it out in a way, but also baking it down so that elements of it can break down further and allow them to mix with whatever you're kind of cohabitating within the digestion chamber. So if you have, and actually in creating a spagyric stone, one of the final processes is to digest the stone, because by this point you've added the sulfur and mercury back into the salt through cohabation. And it's been able to absorb them, but it's still kind of just like sitting there having sponged it up. So if you were to put it into a high heat, you would dissolve off the volatile mercury and sulfur. By putting it into a low heat, particularly within a closed chamber, you bake those things in, allowing the salt's pores to open up from the heat and further absorb the liquids and kind of fixing liquids into the salt further through the way in which it's baked into the salt at that point. Kind of like if you have a pan and you get grease baked into it and can't get it off. Dissolution, which obviously is just dissolving things. Distillation, which OTO people, I hope, are pretty familiar with because the majority of them are pretty heavy drinkers. I know. Some are cheap dates. And some are straight edgers. But basically the extraction of liquid, either from another liquid or from a physical body, or a solid body. Evaporation, which is basically the same process by which distillation works. But with distillation specifically having the element of recooling the vapors back into a liquid, evaporation not necessarily having that. So in the case of separating out salts, you can evaporate off the water containing the water-soluble salts and leave behind the insoluble salts. Fermentation, in which case you create ethanol by breaking down the sugars within a plant that's being suspended in water. Filtration, in which case you take physical means to separate out one thing from another, either with filter paper, cheesecloth, or some sort of strainer or funnel. Fixation, which he doesn't really describe how that's done, basically just making something volatile, non-volatile. That can be done either through combining a more volatile material with a less volatile material, such as mixing sulfur and mercury, or mixing either of them with the salt. And the process that we described of digesting the stone with the sulfur and mercury in it would be a form of fixation. Maceration, in which case you are putting herbs in some solution, either of water, oil, or alcohol, so that their elements are leached out. Then he gets into sketchier ones, like multiplication, in which case he simply describes it as the great work where the strength of the philosopher's stone is augmented. This is one of the things that I hate about modern alchemy, is that because modern alchemy interprets the philosopher's stone as the mineral stone, you can further refine the philosopher's stone, which is impossible by the nature of the philosopher's stone because it is, by definition, already perfect. So I take multiplication to be any alchemical process that is increasing the efficacy of an alchemically created material. And then he has projection, which again is dealing with making changes in the philosopher's stone. Putrefaction, where you are removing impurities from the body through the process of decay. And sublimation, where you are purifying solids by applying heat so that they become gaseous without going through the stage of being liquid. So those are your basic processes, without trying to correspond them to weird Kabbalistic correspondences that have nothing to do with what you're doing in alchemy. And one of the ways in which you can start approaching those processes in a laboratory context is by creating an archaeus of water. This is sort of one of the most basic forms of water alchemy. To get more basic than an archaeus, a meditation that I tend to recommend to people who ask me, like, well, what can I do to get an idea of what alchemy feels like without having to do a whole bunch of lab stuff, is to take a gas burner or a Bunsen burner or an oil burner and a pot of water and boil the pot of water over the burner, because it allows you to meditate on the rotation of the elements and how the interaction between the fire and the water produces the air, or the moist vapor, which reflects the idea that the elements fold one into the next element. The archaeus goes a bit of a step beyond that, in that it lets you look at that element of exploring distillation, but with the idea of separating out and recombining the base elements and principles. The idea behind an archaeus is that water itself contains the four elements and contains the three principles, because everything contains the four elements and contains the three principles. But water is something that is much more easily separable than other things. So in making an archaeus, you basically separate out the elements. So you separate out the fire of water, the air of water, the water of water, and the earth of water. And then you take each of those four sub-elements of the water and separate out the principles that define those sub-elements. So you have the salt of the fire of water, the sulfur of the fire of water, and the mercury of the fire of water. It all gets very Enochian, but which makes sense when you think about John Dee and Edward Kelly. Now, part of why you would do this, aside from simply practicing distillation and giving you something in which you can kind of meditate on the interaction of the elements with one another, and also on the process of separation and recombination, is that it's recommended in alchemy that any water that you're dealing with be distilled. Part of this is to purify the water, and part of it is to engage the water in an alchemical process in order to kind of separate out the water. And you could think of it as charging it, coming from a magical background.
So if you bought distilled water, it really would be the same?
No, you would still, if you were functioning in a purely spagyric fashion, buying distilled water would be fine. If you wanted to function in a more alchemical fashion, you would buy the distilled water and then distill it, or buy spring water and then distill it. Aside from looking at it as a process of charging up the water, you can look at it as a way of engaging the water, so that through your attention to the distillation, you are creating a link between yourself and the water, and a link between yourself and the work, so that the rest of the work that you're doing with that water in your alchemy is something that you're able to internalize, because the very base that you're dealing with is something that you've already approached in that fashion. The archaeus allows you to do something in which case you are doing that. You're engaging the water through distillation. According to Manfred Junius, the process of making an archaeus also changes the pH level of the water. He says in his book that there have been tests where they make a simple archaeus and they test the pH level beforehand and test the pH level afterwards, and the pH level is higher after the water has gone through the archaeus process, which doesn't seem like it makes rational sense, because you would think if there was something in the water that it would be removed, and so it should be in a more neutral state, unless there was something in the water making it more basic beforehand. But so in conjunction with this pH change, there is also an idea within alchemy of using particular waters because they have more of a natural charge to them, or more of an alchemical fire within the water. And so using water from springs or water from snow are good. More potently, rainwater from a thunderstorm or dew collected during the springtime are two of the other more powerful waters that you can use within alchemy. So you can kind of go through a process of multiplication on something that's not the Philosopher's Stone, by doing the archaeus of water with one of these water sources that's being used. One other element in Cut Noir's description of the archaeus is a process of putrefaction. which Manfred Junius does not include in his description of making an archaeus. And I have not read any classical accounts of them. I've only read them about it in modern texts. So I don't know whether or not this is necessary in classical alchemy. But Cut Noir says that you should be using thunderstorm water in making your archaeus, and you should let it putrefy first so that it has a film over top of it and things growing in it. And that when you process your first set of distillation, separating out the elements, that in the end you will have this kind of filth left over from the kind of putrefied growth that was within the water, and that you should save it and digest it in order to dry it out, because it has, according to classical texts, certain alchemical and medicinal properties. Now, he does note that he has not tested these. That actually got into the writer that I wanted to bash earlier, but I didn't. Maybe alchemy just makes me behave. So, yes, maybe I'll do it at the end. So you might want to try putrefying your water if you're making an archaeus. You might not. The putrefaction would probably explain the pH change. But
well, I mean, if you collected rainwater, it automatically has other stuff in it.
Yeah.
Every droplet forms around a particle.
Mm-hmm. And so the process of distillation alone would affect that. But you would think that it wouldn't necessarily affect it in a consistent manner depending on what the particles are in the rain. But so the first step then is distilling the water. So in order to do this, you need a chamber or a vessel. You typically are going to want something that's glass, or in contemporary tools you would use Pyrex. You could also use clay. You should not use metal unless the metal is glazed. The reason for this is that it's viewed in alchemy that if you are working with the mercury of a kingdom, then it can take on the nature of the things with which it comes into contact. So if you are using metal vessels, you will mineralize your mercury, and then it won't function properly in the plant kingdom anymore.
It is notable that wine tastes lousy out of metal containers.
Yeah. And so I don't know if the problem is that people would have classically been using reactive metals, or if it's just superstition, or if there really is some alchemical thing that happens to the energies and underlying nature when you let a representation of mercury touch metal. But all in all, just use glass. So take your glass or your Pyrex container, put water in it. You'll want to have, in other forms of distillation, something that will measure the temperature of the inside the container. In creating an archaeus, you don't have to worry about that so much because you're not separating out anything except water, so you don't need to deal with differing boiling temperatures. You might want to be able to monitor the temperature, though, for questions of pressure, so that it doesn't get too hot to the point where you're going to start having your vapors expand and excite too much and explode the glass. You will want some type of tubing and some type of seal, in order to close off the vessel, but also direct the vapor out into the condensation chamber. Then you will need another glassware container into which the tube goes, and that container will have to be in something cool, either cool water or ice. You would then heat the initial container. Depending on what it is you're distilling, that would determine the type of heat that you're applying. In this case, because all you're doing is distilling water, you can use direct heat, or you could have a water bath, in which case you have the glassware suspended in a bath of water which is being heated. You would distill over one fourth, of the water. This first fourth is fire. Then the next fourth is air, The next fourth is water, and then the final fourth is earth. You would then take your fire water and distill out the principles in it. Now, the principles come over in order of volatility. So the mercury of the fire of water, then the sulfur of the fire of water, then the salt of the fire of water. Now, on this idea of volatility, this is a point in which we can kind of stop and look at this idea of volatility a little bit. If you think about mercury and sulfur, which are your two volatile components, you're basically looking at kind of the breath or the basic life that is universal to all things. And then you're also looking at the self that insinuates itself upon that universal life and takes a piece of it and makes it its own. Both of these are things which are kind of fleeting and changing and move from state to state easily. The kind of underlying nature of life that everything shares is, of course, shared by all things, and so takes all forms. The individual self moves from state to state. So you have it fixed within the body or not fixed within the body, kind of moving in different directions through life, moving in different directions through the course of its being. When it the two of these come together and are fixed to a body and have an actual physical life, that's where they're within their most fixed point. So you have the two volatile items fixing themselves into being less volatile by coming together, and then further removing their volatility by combining within the fixed substance of the salt or the body. That's all basically the same thing. Once you have separated out all of your principles of all of your elements, then you recombine them. So first you take the most volatile and put it into the least volatile. So you take the mercury of fire and you add that to the salt of fire. This is typically the same process you're going to have in cohabation within an actual spagyric work. You're going to add in the mercury first. Then you would add in the sulfur. And the reason that you're doing this on some level has to deal with that volatility. The mercury being the most volatile needs to be fixed first so that it doesn't evaporate off into nothing. Additionally, the nature of the volatility of the sulfur requires that it have something to which it can fix itself. And the idea is that the sulfur does not directly bind to the salt on its own. It binds to the salt when it is bound by the mercury. And we can see this echoed in several different forms of magic. If you look at traditional Wiccan ritual, the goddess is always invoked before the god. And they come up with a lot of different ways to explain why this is done. But the basic idea is that the goddess is all of nature, and the god is life acting upon nature. And so nature must be invoked first before the god has something to act upon. Another way that they explain it is that the power of the goddess comes from the interaction with the god, and so he must act upon her in order for her to have the power to manifest. This is the same thing in alchemy, because this is what Wiccan theology is based on. Mercury is basically the dark sea of all creation. It's Nuit, the night sky, the infinite. And it doesn't take on any nature until the sulfur acts upon it. So the mercury must be introduced first in order for the sulfur to be introduced and the sulfur to have something to act upon. The mercury is introduced to the salt because it has to be fixed in order for the mercury to be able to act upon it. Otherwise, you're going to create something that just flits off and has no real grounding. Once you have combined each element back into the element and all the principles are one again, then you combine the elements in the reverse order in which they were separated. So you take the earth first, and you combine in the water, and then combine in the air, and then combine in the fire. And this kind of echoes the kind of mirror that you see between creation and initiation in a lot of magical structures, in which the process by which creation unfolds is the opposite of the process by which initiation unfolds, because initiation is an involution of that evolutionary process of creation, because you're moving back to the beginning through a series of initiations. It's the same process that you're going here with alchemy, because in alchemy you are exploring and understanding nature in order to take apart the parts of nature and put them back together in a way that's greater than the way in which they started. So, outside of the process of water alchemy into actual plant alchemy, the big thing you would have to do first is to produce all of the principles. So, one of the things that you'll see debated sometimes is whether or not you should remove the mercury first or remove the sulfur first. Now, as we saw in the Archaeus, mercury comes out first. The problem with this in plant alchemy is that sulfur binds very strongly to mercury because of the way in which they dissolve one into another. It's very difficult to remove the sulfur from the mercury once the mercury is separated, if you have not already removed the sulfur. The plus side of doing it that way is that you basically go through a simple winemaking process in order to create the base for the mercury, if you start off with creating the mercury first instead of creating the sulfur first. And so in that process, you might have something that you could keep as a drinkable substance and enjoy in addition to what you're doing with your alchemical work. Another element of this question is that if you are creating the mercury on its own, mercury is universal. So once you have the ethanol separated out by itself, then it's the same as ethanol from any other source. So it kind of begs the question of, well, if I'm going to be working with, what's your favorite herb?
Thyme.
Okay, if I'm going to be working with thyme, why should I ferment thyme when I can just take some wine and distill the ethanol out from the wine? I mean, part of the reason that you would do that is to engage the process. But another reason in which you would do that is if you start out with thyme and ferment the thyme, then it's going to have elements of the sulfur from the thyme within the mercury. And even once you go through the process of distillation to separate it out, you're not going to get a completely pure distillation in most cases, unless you start using like chemical methods in addition to the distillation method. So you're able to have your mercury kind of predisposition to the rest of the work that you're doing if you distill out the, if you generate the mercury before removing the sulfur. Now, if you want a pure mercury, or if you need the sulfur itself, then you would want to separate out the sulfur first. And you would do this through steam distillation. Basically, you would set up the same type of distillation apparatus that you had for your archaeus of water. But you would take your herb, so you take your thyme, and you put it in your water, either just distilled water or an archaeus that you've created. You put that into the heating chamber. So say we're using old alchemical equipment, you might have a retort there that you're using. So a bulbous ball with kind of a rod at the end, so a giant male genitalia.
This all sounds really familiar. You mentioned just a minute ago this is what you do with wheat, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you can go somewhere to buy this equipment.
Yeah. So when doing steam distillation, you don't want to scorch your herb, so you would not want to use direct flame on your retort. And this gets into how alchemically there are different levels of fire, and flame itself is like the fourth degree of fire. You also have sand or iron baths, which are the third degree, ash baths, which are the second degree, and water and steam baths, which are the first degree. which is what you would want to be using in this case of steam distillation. When distilling the oils from the plant, the oils are going to come over at a slightly lower temperature than the boiling point of the water. And because the water is heating up in the process and kind of breaking things down in the plant and loosening up the oil, and the oils are heating up in the process and ready to evaporate, they're going to get mixed in and start to bind with the water. Because you're creating a physical state that allows them to bind together, even though oil and water typically would not mix so cleanly. The oil and water combination will come over in your distillation train and will congeal or condense in the condenser. And then eventually they'll separate because of the differentiation in weights. Now, you can take this, and Frater Albertus is big on saying that you need a suck sled extractor, which is like this weird apparatus that you can put your oil and water distillate into, and because of the weight of it, it will separate it out using a stopcock. Yeah, it's really ridiculous, isn't it?
It really is. But we used it to make absinthe.
You could just as easily take the distilled water container that you bought your distilled water in, poke a hole in it, plug the hole, and release, and then stop. It would be the exact same as the stopcock. There are all kinds of ways in which you can kind of create sort of alternatives to buying expensive lab equipment. Or buy lab equipment that just makes more sense than things that have really complicated setups. You can also centrifuge the oil and water apart from one another and then decant them off. Or use a like a dropper thingy to remove it. Whatever the proper term for that would be. Not turkey baster, but
it's
the
like
same idea. Yes, thank you. Words are apparently not my strong suit tonight. So that would be basically how you remove the water, the oil. If you use one of the hotter types of baths, then you will kind of burn the plant and not be able to use the plant for the rest of the alchemical process. Now, if you want to create mercury with the sulfur combined with it, then you would take a separate like supply of the plant. So you've got your 5 pounds of thyme that you're using to generate your sulfur, and then another 5 pounds that you're using to generate your mercury. You would put that in a bucket of water with fermenting sugar and yeast, and allow that to start the first phase of fermentation. And then once the first phase of fermentation is finished, you would put it in a carboy with a fermentation lock and basically finish the winemaking process with it. And when that is done, you would then take the wine, filter out the plant material. The plant material you would then save for generating the salts. Put the wine in your distillation chamber and begin to distill out the alcohol. The methanol will distill off at a lower temperature than the ethanol. So your first distillation, you don't want to take up to the temperature at which you would be distilling your ethanol, which is about 78 degrees. But usually you're going to look at around 75 or so to give yourself kind of a cushion. So anything distilling over below that temperature, you want to save, you want to remove and then discard, or possibly save for other uses. Then you would begin your distillation again. Do that until you don't really get anything distilling over at the lower temperature. Once you get to the point where nothing's distilling over until it gets into the 70s, that's when you're going to start having your ethanol come over. Now your initial distillation will have a good bit of water in it as well. After that first distillation, you would redistill and be a little bit stricter with your target temperature, close to the 78 degrees. Depending on which text you are looking in, it will give you different instructions for the number of times which you have to rectify your distillation. Now, Cote Noir does not talk about rectification through distillation. Albertus is big on it, though, and says that everything needs to be rectified by distilling 7 times. There's a few points where Cote Noir talks about time and efficiency as factors. And if you have enough time to do this a whole bunch of times, sure, go ahead and do it. If not, you're probably fine after this many. If you are making the mercury without the sulfur, then it would be the same process. You would just use the same plant matter that you already used to take the sulfur out in the previous distillation. Once you have your mercury and your sulfur, then you would obtain your salts. So you take that same plant matter that's all gooey and wet now, and you put that into a calcination chamber. And typically for this type of calcination, you would be doing an open calcination, so the chamber would not be sealed. When you're doing the calcination, you'll see some people talk about avoiding charring the plant because they'll either talk about it damaging the salts, or they'll talk about it disrespecting the salts, or somehow removing some of their essential purity. The temperature at which your salts begin to fuse or burn is like crazy high. You have to do that in like a kiln. So for the most part, you could use 4th degree fire for your calcination and probably need to. Or you can calcine in a kiln. But if you were to do anything below 4th degree fire, you'd probably want to use either the sand bath or iron bath. You're not going to be able to calcify in a water bath. The idea here is that you are burning down the plant material until it's a pure ash. So you're not catching it on fire. You are essentially burning everything out of it and roasting it to the point where it blackens. And then you are roasting that blackened ash so that it eventually purifies out into a white-gray ash. And so in this process, part of why you're generally going to have an open calcination is that frequently you're going to have to kind of stir out and break down what's going on in the calcination chamber to make sure that the ash isn't like clumping and just burning, but actually allowing the stuff that you're trying to get rid of to burn off. Once you have the white ash, you'll still have some debris there, and so you use like a mechanical filtration to filter that out. So like some type of sieve or funnel or like grating in order to catch anything that's larger than the ash in it. From there, you want to remove your insoluble salts, or the salts that won't dissolve in water. So you take your ash and put it into a tray of water, and then let the water sit out and evaporate. You want to give it some time so that the soluble salts can dissolve in the water. Then the soluble salts will all evaporate off with the water, and the insoluble salts will be left within the container. There'll still be some water in the insoluble salts, so you would then digest the salts with that slow, low heat until they bake down and are dry, at which case they'll generally be caked together, and so you'll have to crush and break apart the salts, but you'll have your insoluble salts then. The soluble salts, if you evaporate them off by distillation, you can use a process of circulation to start removing the water-soluble salts and separate out the solution that's been created and obtain the salts that begin crystallizing on the circulation surface. So that way you have the soluble salts also if what you're doing calls for the soluble salts. Now, those are the basic processes in the plant kingdom that you would use in order to generate your base materials. There are other specific materials that you might need which would involve other processes, like if you have to create a vinegar from the wine instead of spirit of wine, which is what the ethanol is. There are ways in which you might have to create tartar salt specifically, and may use that to rectify the wine in other ways. So there are some other processes that you would use, but those are the basic processes that are described in most texts. With those, you then have the components for making tinctures, magistries, and stones. For a tincture, you would combine, and this differs from author to author, either the oil with the ethanol or the salt with the ethanol. For magistry, you combine all three into a solution that's primarily based on the ethanol. So this is kind of the closest thing to like a liquid medicine or an elixir that you would be creating. And for a stone, you're doing the same thing that you do in the magistry, except that you're focusing on the salt as the base. So you're recombining the sulfur and the mercury into the salt in order to create a physical substance, which is then baked down. And the nature of the stones, spagyric stones, gets described in different ways. But generally, it'll be kind of waxy, a bit reddened, and sometimes it can change phase due to heat, moving from kind of a more solid to a more liquid phase. Sometimes, depending on the way in which it's digested and the materials that are used to create it, you may actually get a solid, glassy, wax-like stone, as opposed to a powder, which you'll get in many cases. And that's pretty much it. That's the basics of laboratory spagyrics and laboratory alchemy within the plant kingdom. Any questions?
I have a question. Maybe you touched on this last week. What is, so this system of alchemy or spagyrics, what is the end goal, lofty goal of the system? So Donald Tyson would say that the lofty goal of the end of the Enochian system is to cause the apocalypse. Alchemy, is it to make gold? Is it to do what?
In alchemy, we did talk about it a little bit last week. We're going to talk about that more next week. But the idea is that all the stuff that we look at in the great work and in initiation and magical systems, a lot of that is really derived out of alchemy. And in engaging in alchemy, you are engaging in processes where you understand the world and the workings of nature in a way in which you are going to recognize the way in which these same forces that you're dealing with in your lab play out within your soul and play out within the world around you, and that through creating corrections to things within your lab through this alchemical work, you are able to create those changes within yourself as well, and therefore instigate initiatory processes within yourself through reflection on the work that you're doing alchemically. Another thing that is kind of, I'm tempted to say that it's kind of like a modern thing, but there are some old texts that talk about this, is the idea of creating elixirs that relate to different initiatic or magical forces. So like you might create, like Cut Noir talks about creating a series of planetary tinctures and planetary magistries, which is a pretty common idea amongst modern spagyricists and modern alchemists, is that you would have one for each of the planets, and then when working with the different planetary cycles in an initiatic sense, you would use those as a way to align yourself with those planetary vibrations. In dealing with things in a purely spagyric sense, or even in an alchemical sense, you can also look at it as a way of creating medicines and materials that will help people change and correct things in themselves by either augmenting the power of the herb that's being used. So like if you have an herb that has some particular medicinal faculty, then by breaking everything apart and removing everything that's unimportant to that, and then recombining all the essential parts of the herb, then you are approaching that medicinal faculty in a much purer sense, and so it's going to have a more potent response. And that's outside of any magical consideration of it. And that's what you'd be doing in spagyrics. In a more alchemical sense, because you've gone through it in the more refined process in which you've engaged in that change within yourself and that change within the material, you're transmuting the material on a greater level, so it's operating on a higher vibration. And because of that higher vibration, the natural nature and powers that that herb had are augmented into a higher level, so that when you are giving someone this, it's able to change their vibration in a more powerful way. So like if you look at it in terms of like what's talked about in the Kabbalion, which is hermetic but not alchemical, it talks about sort of rhythms and a law of rhythm, in which case the universe kind of works on like this big wave, and you're going to move along the different parts of the wave. And part of mastery is being able to change your vibration so that you are at the peak of the wave regardless of what's happening. And if you need to function at some lower part of the wave, you're still functioning it essentially from that peak consciousness. So you're still controlling what's happening along the lower ends of the wave. And so it's that same type of vibrational change that you're dealing with in alchemy when you're applying the material for a medicinal basis. Now, in a more legendary sense, you would, of course, be attempting to create the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life, which we'll get into next week a little bit more when we talk about how the concepts of alchemy apply to life and how they apply to magic and what some of the underlying nature of alchemy is related to those things. Where spiritual alchemy is a lot of kind of like giving you terminology and a thought process for approaching initiation, and then physical alchemy is a way of engaging that in a physical context, but also creating things which may be useful along the way. What we'll be looking at is something kind of outside of the two that's not talked about as much, sort of applying the alchemical mindset and the alchemical process to the rest of your work as an initiate.
Okay.
Does that answer the question?
Not quite
apocalypse,
but...
No.
We can work on that.
See, initiatically speaking, when...
Not every practice ends up blowing shit up.
Well, no, an Adeptus Minor Theoricus would begin working on alchemy, because that's where you would be dealing with the mercury of the sun. And then when you are an exempt adept, you would be working on the Enochian phase of initiation to the point where you're creating your personal apocalypse. So the work as an Adeptus Minor Theoricus lays the groundwork for the rest of what you're doing in the Adept cycle to some degree. Because
okay.
A lot of the language that D would be using is the alchemical language, so they inform each other. Yeah, the secret nature of the way in which all the Adept degrees work is going to be explained in my Planetary Magic book, which is not yet released. But that chapter is actually written.
Ooh.
Yes. Any other questions? Ooh. I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign.